welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy, and it was a real delight to catch up on the Medway campus of the University of Kent with Alan Legree, who's my guest this week. Alan has taught for us for many years in the Religious Studies department, and he talks about growing up in the South London suburbs on the edge of the largest council estate in the UK, a house that he thought when he was young might be haunted. Alan reflects on how at school he was the last child to be picked in football, but in later years he's done a lot of running, for example in the London Marathon. Alan talks about the ritual of dressing the part and the aphorism that one needs to make something routine so that it becomes so much part of your rhythm that you are freed to enter into it. We find out about the role that music has played in Alan's life, principally in the form of Bach, Beethoven and the Beatles. And we find out which of the Beatles' eras he considers to be headache music and why. He talks about returning to playing the piano in later years to grade 5 standard and how he has recently accumulated around 10 hours of flying experience as a student pilot. Now, Alan has 3 degrees from King's, but he doesn't consider himself to be an academic. We have a really good conversation actually around the theme of imposter syndrome and fraud syndrome, and he never considered either ordination or going to university until it was suggested to him by his school teachers. Alan talks movingly about the death of his father and how his world totally collapsed. This happened while he was in the midst of writing an essay during his undergraduate degree, and this was a deep formative experience. And at the final part of the interview, we discuss the art of competitiveness and whether it's the process or the end goal that matters, and the way in which Alan believes the past can be thought of as being reframed by the future. So my name is Chris Deasy, and it's an absolute pleasure this week to have as my guest Alan Legree. Well, I am in Medway today, and thank you to Alan Legree for inviting me to this campus.
Thank you very much for coming.
So I have, it's early July, and so driving in the sunshine from one end of Kent to the other is, you know, all part of this
not
wider...
Not the other end of Kent, you're only in mid-Kent here.
That's true, actually, yeah. Because I've been as far as sort of Tunbridge Wells, which does feel like a long drive. Mm-hmm. But I now live, recently moved to Stelling Minas, which is near Canterbury, but I'm sort of closer to Dover and Folkestone, which is parts of Kent
it's
I don't really know.
The back of beyond, you know.
Yeah, but lots of seaside.
Maybe. Lots of seaside. Yeah. Yeah. Now, I've recently taken to having a few flying lessons, and we regularly fly over in that direction. In fact, actually, last week, I was being taught to line up at Manston Airfield. We didn't land, of course, but we were lining up over it, you know, so I feel as if I'm beginning to know the area a little better from the air.
From the air, well, that's something we need to come back to, I think, yeah. So trying out new experiences. Yeah. I mean, for me, it's doing all these sort of like podcasts on the beach, or, you know, here I am at Dover Beach, short
Matthew
of...
Matthew Arnold had something to say about that, didn't
Well, I realised the irony afterwards, because I'd put this up on Facebook, and I said, I'm on Dover Beach. And as I was talking, I thought, hang on a minute, I teach Death of God, Cupid, Sea of Faith. Yeah. But suddenly here in Alphas, I thought, I'm going to go back to Dover, and I'll do that. Yes. Although it might look a little contrived.
Yeah, but depends which beach you're on.
Yeah. I suppose. Well, it was actually just after England had beaten, was it Paraguay 6-1? 6-1 the other week. And let's put it this way, when I was walking through the streets of Dover, it wasn't Matthew Arnold that came to mind. Something a little less local. Yeah. Culturally, a little bit lower. Yeah. But anyway, so. Yeah. Well, but no, they were very happy and excited.
Well, there's a nice fish and chip shop just around the back of Dover High Street there, where you can get some fish and chips and go and sit on the beach and eat them.
I think that would have been the right place to sit. I think walking past the pubs on a Sunday afternoon wasn't where I was to be. And somehow lived theology and death of God theology was, you know, would you believe it, slightly, you know, a little bit farther away from the centre of my consciousness.
That little bit of beach that's inside the harbour area there, I think probably coheres quite well with the death of God type of imagery. It's not the most luxurious place to sit and eat, is it?
Yeah. But I was thinking, because when I was filming, the White Cliffs didn't look quite as white somehow on film. Yeah. But I was sitting there, and it took me back to my grandparents, because certainly Vera Lynn, who's still alive.
Well, you know, there are no bluebirds in Kent, don't
you? Well, I looked for them.
I think it's an American bird or something, isn't it? But they don't inhabit the British Isles.
Well, there we go. That was a waste of time. No, but sitting there with Vera, you know, the thought of Vera Lynn. And I felt, as I was doing it, you know, history, because, you know, talking about Dover, you know, has a huge, you know, certainly my grandparents' generation, you know, growing up in the 1920s and 30s, and they met in the Second World War, then, you know, now living just a few miles up the road from there, I do kind of feel that there is more to do, you know, in terms of my family, you know, ancestry.
Yeah, roots and all that.
So that's amazing. Yeah. But tell me about your roots, Alan. Yeah, so sort of where and what you don't be as specific as, or, as you want, but tell me a bit about where you were born.
Okay, so I was born and spent the first part of my life, first 13 years of my life, in a place called Carshalton, which is nowadays called South London, outer London suburbs, right on the edge of suburbia. I can remember, however, as a young child on holiday, asked that question, where did you come from? I said, I'm from Carshalton. They said, oh, London. And I was horrified. I said, no, sorry, because it was very clearly not London in those days. But I was born at home in a house that was on the edge of what I later learned was the largest council estate in the UK, 50,000 houses plus, I think, on the GLC, what was the old London County Council estate, called the St Helier Estate. But we didn't actually live on that estate, we lived on the edge of it in a house that was privately rented. I spent my first few years there, living at home with mum and dad and elderly great-grandparents who were living in the same house as we were. And the story about the house was actually quite interesting because it was actually the council discovered that it had been built over an underground river, and the foundations of this Victorian house had been steadily eroded over the years. So we lived in this house that was constantly creaking and groaning. The family joke was it was because it was haunted, you know, so we used to talk about Cecil the Ghost. That was in the house, and doors would mysteriously swing open and funny things like that. But after a while, when I was about seven, it was coming up to about seven, the council came round, and there was some action. I was too young to know what was going on, but some action was taken, and the council ended up condemning the house as unfit for human habitation. So we had to move out pretty quickly, and we moved about a mile or so down the road, to a council estate. The council rehoused us there, and I lived there for another 6 or 7 years, and so went to local primary schools there. You know, can still remember having to go to school. I have a September birthday, so I was not eligible to go to school right at the beginning of the school year, but for some reason which I don't understand, I actually started school on my birthday at the end of September, and I can remember being outraged that this was a totally unacceptable way of celebrating one's birthday, being dragged off to school for the first time. But it was a nice school, I enjoyed that. That was on the estate, that was on the St Helier estate. And then when we moved a little bit further down the road, we obviously had to change schools, and I went to another school, the other side of the estate, a place called Hackbridge. On the other side there.
But birthdays, it's funny because a lot of people who are born around September feel slightly aggrieved, I think. I mean, one of my daughters was born on the 19th of August, and she was due to be born on the 2nd of September, and she would actually still be at nursery now, and she's thriving at school, but it just goes to show how important it is. But you just reminded me of something. When I was about 14, it was the 1987 election, and we got so carried away, we thought, some friends of ours, we thought, hey, you know, rather, you know, Tory or Labour, let's form our own party. And we had this sort of idea that it was like the things that school children would really want, not that we had the vote. Maybe that was one of the things in our manifesto, but one of them was, if it's your birthday, you're allowed to have the day off. Could you imagine? So in the real world, I think parents are sort of, well, actually, you know, we need to go to work, it's your birthday, we will celebrate in a timely fashion. But when you're that age, you sort of feel, it's my birthday. Or maybe, actually, I just didn't want the bumps.
But
the haunted house thing, I mean, Cedric the Ghost, but was was, I mean, you said it was condemned, but do you think it, I mean, obviously, as a theologian, you know, do you sort of look back and think, you know, do you look back and think, what was the reason for, yeah, no, for all of that?
No, I'm afraid.
I'm disappointed.
No, the rationalists would kick in there, you know. To be absolutely honest, I don't think we thought as children, even. In terms of spookiness, the most spooky memories I have of that particular house was, I mentioned that my great-grandparents were living in a couple of rooms. It was quite a big house, a couple of rooms upstairs. And Grandma Ethel, I think her name was, yeah, died in the house. And after she had died, there was this kind of wistfulness about the house. She only died, I suppose, a couple of years before we moved. So it wasn't that long. And then, just before we moved, literally a few months before we moved, Grandpa Finch, as we knew him, also died. And then that was my first experience of that kind of empty home. You know, I can remember my parents emptying his rooms upstairs and taking the furniture out. And then we used to use it as a playroom, you know, for the few months that we were there. But it had that hollowness about it, you know, that missing feeling. And when you went into the room, you could still feel Grandpa's presence. You know, he was a lovely man, and we remember him with great affection as the sort of benign figure, cuddly figure in the background. And that was that first kind of experience of something missing there, you know.
Would you say that was one of your earliest memories?
Not one. I'd say Grandma Ethel would be one of the earliest memories. No, not earliest memories. I mean, I've got earlier memories than that, I think. But I do have vague memories. She was a very Victorian woman. And so I'm talking about, I was born in 1951, so I'm talking about sort of 1955, 56, that kind of period, when she died. So I would have been very young, so not many memories. But I can still see her as a shadowy figure in the background, you know. And I had this memory, it's probably a false memory, but I have a memory of her wearing a kind of Victorian dress with a lacy collar, you know, and black kind of full-length costume, as it were, you know, dress on. So, yeah.
I always had this urge to want to sort of try and corroborate some of these memories, because sometimes you know that they're composites.
Yeah.
You look back, like the image that you're thinking of, there are probably lots of different occasions that all merge into one event.
And a little bit of Victorian drama on the telly.
Absolutely,
well,
like Gaslight or whatever, you know. Yeah. So you give it a bit of like a thriller to like the family connections. Yeah. But because I've always kept a diary, sometimes I didn't used to write very much, but you know, there will be particular episodes from, say, when I was a student, and I think, you know, that was a good day. But to actually see in the diary, on the day, sort of, you know, I'm acknowledging there was something a little bit special about this. And the fact, and, you know, to find that out 20-odd years on, but to be thinking back, you know, what was it that made an occasion special? And certainly in childhood, it's the sort of sense that you can't recapture certain moments because perhaps the people are no longer there.
Yeah.
But you kind of, you feel that they're always a part of you, that they're very much, you know, you journey with them.
Very powerful memories. I mean, after Grandma had died, Grandpa, we were beginning to get a little bit older then, of course, but it became a routine for that year or two. It seemed like an age for us as children, but it would only have been a couple of years at maximum. But we got into this routine that we would go in and wish him good night when we were going to bed, and he would sit us down, and it was like one of those kind of adverts you see on the telly for Werther's, I think it is. And we'd sit us down and give us the sweets, and he'd chat to us and read us a story in front of the fire, you know. So it was all very kind of very cosy and comfortable. And,
yeah.
He was a lovely man, you know. We remember him with great affection.
So, what do you particularly enjoy? You know, what did you enjoy doing as a child? Are there particular maybe sporting activities or reading?
No, I've always been absolutely hopeless at sports. Later on at secondary school, and indeed actually still at primary school, whenever there were any sporting activities, I was always the last kid to get picked. You know, and I have a vivid memory of at primary school, we went off to the local park to play football as a school, you know, so it was a school-organised event. And two team captains had been appointed, and they were given the responsibility to pick their teams, you know. And I was literally the last person left in this class to be chosen. And I can still hear the PE teacher saying, you'll have to take Alan. And this poor captain protested, oh, God, have we got to have him? And I said, So, no, sport never figured that highly.
Although I've got an even worse story to tell you about that, because not only was I the last to be picked, on one occasion, maybe out of pity, the PE teacher gave me the chance to pick my team. Because what I should have done is picked all the really good players, and then I could say, yes, my team won. But because I was so out of my depth and, you know, I'd never had this experience, I picked all my friends. I was too embarrassed to pick these people who wouldn't want me to pick them, I thought. So I picked all my friends who were, like me, hopeless players. And of course we were thrashed, and everyone afterwards was like, I'm ashamed to be on your team. I know.
There were wonderful moments that where one could kind of treasure that. I can remember on one occasion the PE teacher, I think, who out of sympathy got me into one of the sports day teams, which was, I think they called it pass ball or something, where you just have to stand in two lines and throw a ball to each other down the line, you know, in a relay thing. And we won. Yeah, and so we were given a little badge as a reward for winning this, and I wore this with great pride because it was the only sports thing I ever got as a kid, you know. But my sporting prowess has been absolutely dreadful. I mean, much later, when I was teaching at Cudston, I would find myself on occasions filling in, you know, if they didn't have enough players for the college team, you know. And there was one famous occasion where they were playing rugby against Oak Hill Theological College, actually, and we were in North London on their playing field for this game. And I've been obviously put to back. We had some really strong rugby players and serious players in our college team, but they were short, so I was making up the numbers. So I'm at the back, you know, and I can remember there was one occasion when I could see the ball coming towards me. And I thought, oh my God, I better do something with this. You know, so I caught it and ran like the clappers towards the line and couldn't understand why there was this stony silence. Yeah. And then when I actually stopped and saw that no one was following me and it was all sort of sheer disbelief on the faces of everybody else, that somebody said, Alan, you're running the wrong direction.
Sounds like the forerunner to Forrest Gump.
My only excuse was that because it was a rugby match, I hadn't got my glasses on because it obviously didn't get smashed. So I hadn't a clue. Everything was a blur anyway. But not that it would have made that much difference, I don't think. Yeah. So sports has never been a particular forte. Until relatively recently, actually. I mean, for health reasons, 4 years ago, almost exactly 4 years ago, I had a minor health scare, which turned out to be absolutely nothing. But when I went to go and get the results of the tests, I had braced myself to be given some bad news because I thought it was, you know, I thought there was going to be some problems. And I thought I was going to come out clutching a prescription as long as your arm for all sorts of drugs, and was obviously thinking, well, I need to take those drugs if they're prescribed. Instead, the doctor said, all the tests are perfectly okay, all within limits, no problems whatsoever. He said, the only thing you need to do is change your diet and get some exercise. So I sat there thinking, if he had given me a prescription, I'd have taken the tablets. His prescription is, go and do some exercise. So since then, I've been running. And so for the last 4 years, I've been doing more sport in the last 4 years.
I remember now, because you, I think I even sponsored you some years ago.
At least on one occasion, if not more, because in the last 4 years, I've done at least one sponsored event every year. Yeah.
You did the run, didn't you? Was it 5K?
I did the London Marathon 2 years ago, which was sponsored for Christian Aid. And I was very pleased about that. Actually, the training for the marathon was really quite an enterprise. I mean, it's a big deal. You do have to do quite a lot of training for it. But I'd say even more hassle was sorting out sponsorship. Because the way these deals work is the charities are given so many places by the organisers. And then they sell those places. They literally sell them. Yeah. So the deal is that I got a place from Christian Aid, but they wanted me to guarantee that I would raise a minimum of £2,000. So you've now got to go around and tap on everybody's shoulder and raise as much money as you possibly can. In the event, we raised just over £3,000, I think, which was very good. But that sense of satisfaction when you cross the finish line. So 4 hours, 58 minutes.
Really?
Time. Yeah, I'm really smug and proud about that. I'd set out to try. I was hoping I might be able to get round in 5 hours. But 4 hours, 58 sounds so much better.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, yeah. So now you've got that benchmark.
Yeah.
So next time.
And the medal. Yeah, of course. Yeah. So good. But I did another one, 6 weeks ago, I suppose now, maybe 2 months ago, a half marathon, raising money for our son, Peter, who died last November. So that also was raising some money for the local Medway hospital. So about once a year, I do a sponsored run.
I think that's amazing because for me, I've always bracketed out sporting things in my life, maybe more like armchair sports. Yeah. But what you do, that's doing it for charity as well, and actually the effort that goes into it, because it's so easy. I mean, for me, I find it really hard after a day at work not to do something that's kind of physical. I may end up at the cinema, but it's the journey there, it's the trek there, and doing something different. I can't just sort of go and sit.
The worst bit's getting out the door. If you can get out the door, then there's something actually, you also have to dress the part. It's a bit like church, really. You dress the part. Once you put the gear on, you kind of feel committed. Because if you don't go for a run, then you feel quite stupid, because you've got all the gear on. But, I mean, this evening, for example, I'm going for a run with one of our local running clubs here. I know that come 7:15, the run will be at 7 o'clock. I know come 7:15, I will be thinking of every reason under the sun why I don't need to go, and you have to put the gear on, and then shame kicks in, Then you get yourself down to the starting point, and then you stand there for a few moments as everything gets organised. It's always the same. And you kind of think, what the hell am I doing here? Why? I could be doing something much more interesting, or just watching the telly or whatever. Then you get going, and then you just get on with it.
Because I recently started, literally just a couple of weeks ago, mindfulness training.
Oh, yeah.
Start mindfulness.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is so not me. But I thought, I have to buy the mat, so I've got a purple yoga mat, and I even put that up on social media, so everyone knows that I'm, doing it, not maybe quite every day, but again, I think when I start something, like these interviews are a good example, I sort of, it's something that maybe was in the pipeline for years. In my head, I imagined doing this, but when I actually started doing it, there was no looking back. Yeah. And I think, if I was able to do something along the lines of what you're doing, which must be, so wonderfully healthy, I could probably commit to it. But it might take me a long while to get to that stage.
It's a little bit like the spiritual life, so I've been told, because I've never really got that far with the spiritual life. But it's that kind of, you have to make something routine so that it becomes so much part of your rhythm that you are then freed to enter into it. You know what I mean? So that you have to really push yourself to get into that rhythm. But once you're in the rhythm itself feeds you. So that you have that kind of freedom to be able to operate within it. And the running is a bit like, so my discipline is now with the running, I commit to running a minimum of 5K 3 times a week. Yeah? And so you then, you plan your week around it, and then you get on with it and you do it.
But I always feel it's so disappointing if you've got a student, for example, who is nervous about giving a presentation and so skips the presentation. Yeah. In some cases, they get a mark of 0 for that component of the module. And then a few years later, they say, can you write a reference for me? I want to be a teacher. And you think, well, I really wish you well. However, and that's what I mean. I think sometimes there are all sorts of ways of dealing with and trying to overcome. Yeah. We will help them in student support. That's what we'll do. Any sort of inhibition. But that's what I mean. I think that once you start on something, and then you commit to it, and then often there's no looking back. Yeah. And sometimes there are some teachers, some students I taught who I would never imagine as teachers. However, they're thriving in grammar schools, I wouldn't have necessarily thought 10, 15 years ago that would be their calling.
You're obviously better at that, Chris, than I am, because I do know that I still actually, once or twice a year, will get letters or emails these days, obviously, from former students. and they will ask me, will you give a reference? And I think, well, I taught you for one module, you know. And I always say to them, you know, well, I don't really know, you know, but isn't there somebody who can give you a fuller reference than I possibly can, you know? But you're obviously a little more disciplined than I am. I'm too soft, I think. I usually give in and say, okay, all right, on the understanding, you know, that I can't say very
well, much. I very rarely refuse a reference, although anything from the police sometimes, yeah. And the police will ring you and say, yeah. Excuse me, you know, can you do it immediately? Yeah. It's like, okay. On one or two occasions, it's not appropriate perhaps to write a reference. But I do sometimes think that, you know, if a student had perhaps thought through the potential pathways open to them, you know, they could, you know, the worst thing sometimes is to look back and think, you're never going to look back and think, I wish I'd gone to fewer classes. You might think, I wish I'd gone to more classes. I often impart that, and they all nod their heads, but you know, they're thinking, well, you know, like, you know, I hear what you're saying, but it's going to take more than that to change. Do you want to go back, because you mentioned the year that you were born, and for me, you know, that period early, obviously it's before my time, but you know, it's when the charts started, and certainly in 52. Yeah, yeah. How big was world music or contemporary music play in your growing up?
I mean, music is a fairly big thing for me, but not contemporary music. Well, I mean, do you remember that wonderful 1970s film? What was it, Love Story or something?
Oh, yeah, with Ally McGraw, Ray O'Neill.
And there's one of their memorable lines in there is when talking about music, Bach, Beethoven and the Beatles. Yeah. Yeah. And that just about kind of sums me up, I think, as well. So I'm in that category of Bach, Beethoven and the Beatles. The Beatles in the 60s, I mean, I became obviously much more aware of it then. But I have to say, I'm one of those plebs who hate the early Beatles. You know, She Loves You, Yeah, Yes, and all that kind of stuff. Headache music. Really didn't like that at all. Sgt. Pepper, the White Album, you know, 1967, all that kind of stuff. That's where they came. That was their peak, you know. And for me, I can listen to that endlessly. You know, I have that on my, you know, on my MP3 player and all that nowadays. And that, you know, but it's mostly classical. But I have to say, I'm not a great classical buff. I'm one of those plebs who likes a nice tune. I don't like anything that's clever or sophisticated. I want something that's got a good structure to it and a good melody. So it is Bach, Beethoven and the Beatles, really. Mm. And the Beatles ballad stuff rather than the early stuff. You know? Yeah.
Well, the pun that comes to mind is obviously, so when you hear the early Beatles, you think, help. But I was actually thinking, I've sort of done the nostalgia route, and often with music that precedes me, like 70s bands like 10cc, or the Stylistics, which I've seen in concert in the course of the last few years.
Our song, Linda. And
I'm not in love.
I can remember sort of as we were doing the early stages of courting, that was very much around, and that became our song.
Yes, I thought you were going to say, Gretel Holliday, you know. Although, actually, I always think of you, because obviously Linda is your wife. Yeah. Whenever I hear the Beach Boys song from Lady Linda, I know lots of songs, and I've got another friend, Simon, who actually I interview, and his wife is called Penny, and I hear Penny Love and Lionel Richie. And I always think, you know, were these their wedding songs? There's all these sort of connections, which music does for me. And because I think when I was growing up, I think my parents sometimes probably thought, you know, every Sunday he writes the charts down, you know, he can't be doing that forever. But the skill that I've learned from doing that, in the sense that the way it helps me assimilate and process information, has really travelled with me.
And there's different kinds of music, isn't it? I mean, I have to be very careful about the music that I'm playing if I'm needing to work, if I've got to concentrate. I have to have what I call wallpaper music. Anything, whether it's the Beatles or, you know, or the Beach Boys or any of the Simon Garfunkel, you know, any of that kind of stuff. Anything, or Beethoven or Bach, anything that requires my concentration, if it makes me stop and listen to it, then it's blown it for the work, you know. So I just have to have wallpaper music, you know, something fairly bland in the background that's just pleasant. No, but I'm not really listening to it that much. You know, it's just kind of wallpaper. And that's really important for me, I think, in terms of nourishment and that. But, I mean, when I went to secondary school, just talking a little bit about the earlier stuff, what I didn't say was my dad was a factory worker, Sven had quite a bit of kind of history around that. He had quite a serious accident at work in the late 50s. It would have been about 1957, I think. And he was off work for a year. He broke his back. In those days, the kind of social security stuff was really quite elementary. So that was quite a tough year for my parents. I mean, I was only about 5 or 6 at the time, so don't remember very much about it apart from what I learnt later and was vaguely aware of at the time. You know, but Mum used to talk about what she used to call egg and chip weeks, because that was all they could afford on the benefits that were available then for that length of time. But he had to change his job. He had to retrain. And he got another job in a factory. And he used to cycle every day to work to and from. But one day he came back, I was 12, coming up to 13, so just started secondary school. And Dad came home in August, that summer holiday, and said that he was quite serious, had a serious conversation with Mum, and then we were called in as children to join in this conversation. And he'd just been told at work that he had to make a choice. The firm was relocating from South London to Stevenage, Newtown, in Hertfordshire. And he therefore had to decide whether he was going to relocate with the firm or be made redundant. So were we going to move as a family from Surrey to Greater London outskirts to Hertfordshire? They said the final kind of wonderful move was he had 3 weeks to make up his mind. Yeah. So Mum and Dad decided that they were going to move to Stevenage, so we all had to relocate that November. That happened in August, so in early November, Guy Fawkes Day, I think, actually, we actually moved to Stevenage to a whole new experience and the whole new town set up, and that was quite interesting. So it was Council House that we lived in on that estate there. So I had to move to a secondary school. I'd already started secondary school and was just moved into my second year when I had to go into a local school in Hertfordshire. That was actually quite difficult again, because obviously the class had consolidated that I joined in Hertfordshire in Stevenage. And they weren't too sure about this newcomer coming in, you know, and there was all sorts of dynamics. And I ended up being quite badly bullied for 2 or 3 years whilst I was there. But I was befriended by a couple of the teachers who I think were taking showing sympathy towards this new boy who was completely lost and disorientated and being beaten up by the other kids in the class. And one of the teachers who took me under his wing was our music teacher. So I was encouraged to develop an interest in music and ended up learning a couple of instruments and joining the school orchestra and the local youth orchestra and things like that. You know, so music became quite an important part, really. I've never really been that good as a musician. I never got any further than kind of grade 5 on any instrument that I've tried, you know. But enough to be able to dabble.
Well, you got further than me with the piano. I had lessons for grade 5, but never sat the exam. Grade 3 is as far as I got.
I did grade 5 as an adult, actually, because I thought it was unfinished business. So when we moved to Cuddesdon, we had a piano teacher, not on the staff, but one of the students was married to a piano teacher. I said, I started having some more piano lessons. I said, if you've got some vacancies, I'll come have a few lessons with you. And I did. And by that stage, I think I had already got to grade 3 on the piano. But so we had to go. She said, you have a go at grade 5. And so I did the practice and had a go. You know, and I could still remember, went off to Oxford to do this wretched grade 5 exam. And I completely collapsed. I mean, as an adult, you know, it's one of the reasons, actually, I think I can understand something of the mature student approach to life, you know, because of all that sense of inadequacy and feeling a complete plonker and all the rest of it. But I sat at the piano for this music and just collapsed. I mean, just completely folded. And at the end of it, I just apologised to the couple of examiners who were there, you know, and they to my great surprise, I think, you know, it was kind of almost an example in mentoring, really, good mentoring. They allowed me to pass by one mark. So I got my grade 5.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
But I felt completely, and that was it. You know, I thought I'm not going to even attempt to do it. And one of the things I've learned, actually, with other instruments that I have played and occasionally still do play, that I'm no good as a soloist. My particular forte, I'm very happy playing in a group, but I hate being a soloist. And with the piano, of course, that's exactly what you want.
Yeah, it's funny how people like, well, Ed Balls, you know, economist by training, politician, almost Chancellor of the Exchequer, but then lost his seat, and he took up, among other, as well as obviously the dancing, but the piano, and I think he took those grade, I don't know how many grades he...
Eight, you can do.
Yeah, but I don't know how far he went, but certainly, you know, so you'd hear him on the Jeremy Vine show on the radio playing the piano, very surreal, but, you know, but I mean, for me, doing piano lessons when I was young, I really didn't have the heart. It didn't fit, it wasn't, it was something more that I thought I should do.
Well, I was made to. My mother always had this kind of thing that she thought I could be a musician. And I still play it, actually. I had this sort of obligatory recorder lessons at school, primary school, and actually did quite well. And believe it or not, ended up, because of some contacts my mum had, there was a guy who was a local music teacher who didn't persuade me because I didn't have any choice in the matter, but persuaded my mother to enter me into something that was called the London Music Festival. I won it 2 years running in my particular class, my age group, and that, you know. And again, another painful memory. See, I can remember the pleasure of winning that particular section of the festival. But the prize was you had to perform in the concert in the Methodist Central Hall. It was in Westminster, and I can remember going up, and I did exactly the same thing. I was standing up in front of this vast crowd and this vast audience, and I collapsed. I just couldn't play. I mean, I stumbled my way through it, but they added to the embarrassment by recording it, and I still have some copy of this recording, and you can hear, I hear all the mistakes that I'm making all the way through, you know. I just hate being the soloist.
But then again, it sounds like only you've got that tape. It's not like, was it Phil Collins at Live Aid, who had to play one of his tunes twice, one in London and the other in Philadelphia, and of course, you know, thousands, millions of people around the world watching, and he played the wrong note, and it was like, oh no. So you know, in that sense, I think Alan, you hadn't admitted it now, nobody would ever know.
There you go. Well, but I mean, in terms of Mum's music, she was the one who always saw herself as the musician in the family, you know, and so she used to push us. So I was pushed into the church choir, for example, because she had been a bit of a singer in her time, so she wanted her son to be a singer, you know, and that's how I really got drawn into the church, through the church choir. But another one of the things was she made me, again, made me, no, there was no negotiation about this, have compulsory piano lessons. You know. So I did do a couple of years piano as a young, I must have been 10, 11, 12, that kind of age, you know. Didn't make very good progress because I didn't want to, you know, and every time I was stumbling and all the rest of it, she used to add to the agony by making me sit at the piano for an hour's compulsory practice, you know. And it was enough to put you off for life, you know, really. So it was only much later as an adult that I decided that I would like to play the piano and came back to it, you know. But those memories as a child, thinking, no way, you know, give this up at the first opportunity, you know.
Well, the question that I would normally ask at this point would be, what made you follow a path, an academic path? Now, obviously, you have done that, very much so, but also, of course, I know you very much as a church figure. So I'm interested in what happened in what sort of order. What was your trajectory after, say, 18?
You say that about an academic. I mean, I think this is... if I was going to analyse my own kind of understanding, I would say that there's something here about social perceptions. Now, I came from council estates. My dad was a factory worker, pretty much textbook old working class, white working class, and I share the same prejudices and biases of sort of council working class background. And I'm not particularly proud of some of those, you know, but that was the environment in which I was embedded and grew up. So I absorbed a great number of those kind of values. And one of the values was that you were preparing for a job, something that you could do practically, you know, and the normal expectation, certainly for kids in my class, and the normal expectation at home, was that I'd probably end up in a factory somewhere, you know, or shop or office, and maybe I was a bit cleverer than some of the other kids, so maybe an office rather than factory, you know, but it wouldn't be anything more than that. I was seen at school as a bit bookish, which was, again, one of the reasons why the kids used to beat me up, you know, because I wasn't out on the football field playing, all that kind of stuff. But I had that little bit of a bookish turn, but I certainly didn't expect to be involved in anything, you say, academic. The curious thing about that heritage is I still don't see myself as an academic. I don't believe I'm an academic. I'm not in the same league as people like you, you know, and I wouldn't even pretend to be in the same league.
But although there is the irony, of course, you were on the interview panel when I got the job here.
Yeah, but that was almost my mistake, wasn't it, Sue? Because because of that connection with Sight. To cut a long story short, because you could almost say this was divine providence if you wanted to take that line through, but because of the deteriorating situation at school where I was regularly being beaten up, and eventually some of the beatings got quite serious and the police started to get involved, and after a while it was some friends from church actually started to make the suggestion that I ought to leave that school and find somewhere else. And I was the last year, last cohort at school that was allowed to leave at 15. And so what was arranged, again, I was starting to be involved a little bit in this, but the decision was taken between us that I would leave this secondary modern school that I was at and go to the local College of Further Education to do O-levels and A-levels. So we did. So I went at 15, just coming up to 16, to do my O-levels at Stevenage College Further Ed, and did quite well in those, actually, and was really quite surprised, actually. I had a summer holiday job that year working in my dad's factory in Stevenage, I can remember taking a phone call with my results from the O-levels and looking at these 7 or 8 O-levels that I'd done, looking at the results and thinking, bloody hell, how did that? It must be a mistake. Yeah. And that became quite a common pattern. I actually looked at the results and said, that must be a mistake. They're going to tell me in a few days' time that that's wrong. Yeah. But because I did reasonably well, the college then encouraged me to sign up for the A-levels. They put me on an accelerated course. So I actually did my 3 A-levels in a year rather than 2 years. But by that stage, I'd already started to think about ministry. In fact, actually, it was the music teacher again at school who we were having one of those conversations after one of the orchestra practices, and he was asking me, what are you thinking of doing when you leave here? And I don't know, you know, I was just kind of musing about this and that. And then he said, from just listening to you, Alan, it sounds to me like you're beginning to think about ordination. And I sat there thinking, I've never thought about ordination in my life, you know. Am I really thinking about ordination? And it was one of those moments, you know, where he'd sown the seed, which had never occurred to me, and never, I never thought that was even a remote possibility. But he just mentioned it had triggered something, so I did start to think about it. And I went to talk to our local parish priest, and he referred me on to the system. You know, I've spent long enough in that system now to know exactly what happened. You know, but I was passed around through that system. Meanwhile, back at Stevenage College Further Ed, I'm doing my A-levels. And halfway through the year, just after sort of January, February time, that kind of thing, it wasn't UCAS in those days, it was UCA.
Yes, it was. Yeah, in my day it was UCA. UCA and PCAS.
It was UCA in my day. And I was doing A-level economic history, actually, with one of my subjects. And the history tutor came up to me in the corridor. And he said, Alan, I'd like to have a word with him. I said, oh, yes, Mr. West, his name. He said, I thought I was in trouble or something like that. And he said, I've been going through all the UCA applications, he says, and I can't find yours. And I said to him, what's an UCA application? Yeah. And he said, well, it's your university application form. And I just remember standing there smiling and saying, why would I have a university application for? And he said, well, you are going to university, aren't you? And I said, am I? You know, it just wasn't a question. It had never occurred to me, you know. Anyway, he persuaded me to fill in one of these wretched forms, which I did. And to my surprise, I then started getting offers. Had to start then later that year, because I did my A-levels in a year. I had a year then, I took a year out, worked for Stevenage Development Corporation for a year. In those days, you couldn't afford a gap year, so you had to work, you know. But I had quite enjoyed that job, actually, at Stevenage Development Corporation. And during that time, then started doing the sort of the open day and the visits around to universities and that, you know. And ended up at King's in London, to cut a long story short. They offered me a place, and my reason for going there was really quite pragmatic, this kind of working class culture thing, you know. I did it for purely vocational reasons. My objective was to get a job as a priest, yeah. And I knew by then that in order to get there, I had to have a theological qualification. The university at King's, well, London University in those days, was offering me a course which would lead to ordination, which in the course of doing that would offer me the opportunity to do a degree. They also ran a parallel course, which in those days was known as the AKC. It's still around, but in different form now. And I assumed that I would do the AKC. That was, in our terms now, our language now, we call that a diploma. Undergraduate diploma, yeah, and I expected that would be my course because, you know, that was my league, you know, that would be pushing it, you know. Nobody else in my class had gone to university. I think two people went off to teach a training college, but nobody else went off to university. It's not, we didn't do it, you know, so I didn't expect to do it. And I can remember when I was actually accepted by King's and they put me on the BD program, as it was then, yeah, feeling completely thrown. And my first 3 weeks at the university, I was in a complete fog. I've never been so disorientated before in my life. And I wandered around like a headless chicken. Yeah. And I missed one or two events because the culture in King's, certainly in those days, was that it was all osmosis, you know. And so you were expected to know the system. And because I didn't know the system and hadn't got a clue what was going on, nobody told me to look on the notice boards to see what I was supposed to be doing. You know, I expected to be told, do this, do that, go somewhere else. You know, but in fact, it took me 2 or 3 weeks to learn to look at the notice boards. You know, something as stupid as that. Yeah. And I can still remember meeting, for the first time in my life, somebody who'd been to public school. Bloody hell, you know. The way it was arranged at King's in those days, you had spent your first year on a general course. Everybody on the ordination track spent a common first year, and then we had a massive kind of end of first year exams, and particularly on Greek and things like that, biblical languages you had to do, and your fate depended precisely on those outcomes and the exams. To my utter astonishment, I was so scared. I spent so much time in that first year expecting to be thrown out because kids like me didn't go to university.
So imposter syndrome.
Yeah, exactly that. I can look back and laugh now, you know. But I can remember my very first week at King's, I bought a university scarf, which was a status symbol, you know, in those days. You don't see them these days, but in those days, it was, I'm at university. And I did it. I can remember saying to one of my mates, I'm going to buy it now because they're going to chuck me out soon. You know, if I don't do it now, I won't have the opportunity. You know? And I spent the whole of that first year expecting it to be chucked out. So one of the results of that was I worked actually quite hard because I thought, I'm going to give it my best shot, you know. And because I put that work in, I was then really quite surprised. I actually not only passed, but actually did quite well. So they put me on the BD. Blimey. You know, so I'm now on the BD. We had a Greek teacher, a guy called Gordon Hewlin, who always talked in a funny voice like this. You know, and one of his favourite lines was he'd always talk about gentlemen, because we were all gentlemen, in this life there are the sheep and the goats. There are the goats who are damned to eternal damnation, and you are the sheep. You are expected to behave like sheep. So we were considered to be the elite. We were the in terms of the Greek, you know, the high class. So again, bloody hell, you know, the bar has been raised. You know, so you better give it your best shot again, haven't you? So we carried on working around that. Got a bit of shock in the second year. I don't want to whistle on too much, really, but anyway. Shock in the second year, halfway through my university career. So the Easter vacation in my second year, when I've got the first lot of big exams coming up immediately after the Easter vacation, my dad suddenly collapsed and died. And so our world kind of imploded. You know, and there's another story around that, but I won't go into that now. But he suddenly, literally, he'd gone out to work one morning and he just never came back again. You know, a bit more to it than that, but not much more. And he died that same day. And our world just totally collapsed. I was 20 when that happened. You know, in fact, actually, one of the powerful memories of that day was all the rest of the family had gone out to work that day. You know. And as the university student, I was sitting at home in our dining room, come living room, you know, the dining room table, with only books on. I had to write an essay for Christopher Evans on the resurrection narratives. Yeah, so it's Easter time, resurrection narratives. I've done all my research for the essay, and I'm just about to write the bloody thing. And the telephone rang, so I'm going to pick up the telephone. It was Dad's work saying, please, can you come straight away, he's been taken off to hospital. So there was that really quite curious juxtaposition of all this thinking about resurrection and resurrection narratives and historical Jesus questions and all that kind of stuff on the one hand, and then being presented with all those existential questions right there in that moment about what do you think about life and death and all that. It was a really formative experience, deep formative experience for me, you know. But anyway, we got through that, and some of the university kings responded extremely well, and they kind of these days we talk about concessions, but they didn't have that language in those days, you know. So they parked me for, gave me a couple of months off, and then I was able to kind of catch up a little bit as I began to find my way around all that kind of emotional mess that was there at that time. Then came into the third year, and the same thing happens again. I'm still expecting, I spent the whole of my undergraduate career at King's expecting to be thrown out next week, you know, that imposter syndrome, you know, and same thing happens again in the third year. As we approached finals, and I do mean finals, because in those days, at the end of 3 years, none of the work that you'd done, none of your coursework, none of your exams, none of that counted. Everything turned.
Exactly my experience.
Yeah, everything turned. We had 9 exams in 10 days. It started on a Thursday morning, so we had Thursday morning, Thursday afternoon, Friday morning, Friday afternoon. Then you had the weekend off, and then it started all over again on Monday. And that's when I started to go grey. That was the most traumatic academic experience of my life, I'd have to say that. And I can remember kind of walking around in the days as we got closer and closer to these finals. And I actually discovered that there was such a thing as an egretat degree, and wondering what I would have to do to qualify so I could get my degree without actually having to do these bloody exams. The exams actually start on Ascension Day, believe it or not. So there's another. Every time Ascension Day comes around, that horror comes back and haunts me every time. But we got on and we did these exams. And I can remember on that Friday lunchtime, after the 3 down and another one to go that afternoon, and then the next lot on the Monday. But I thought, Friday lunchtime, I dared to allow myself to believe that I might actually be able to do this. And I kind of relapsed. And that Friday afternoon was the worst paper I did. It was the philosophy of religion paper. And I thought, Friday afternoon, it's hot summer's day, I've started to relax, I'm catching up with the sleep, and I'm desperately trying to think of all the Aquinas' arguments for the existence of God or whatever it might be. Crikey, this isn't happening. But then finished the exams and went away. And usual story in the summer, had to go and earn a living, had to earn some money over the summer, so I went and worked for a builder's merchant that year, And I came home one evening from work to find a letter from, turned out to be from one of my tutors at King's, and it just had handwritten on the front, first class mail. Yeah, I thought it was a bit odd. No, anyway, I recognised the handwriting. A guy called Colin Hickling had written it. And I opened this letter, and it was just an effusive congratulations on such an excellent result. And I thought, what result? Because it hadn't got the results by then. You know. The result, in those days, came in the post the following day. And I opened this letter, and it said, first class degree. I'm thinking, bloody hell. Yeah, couldn't believe it. And in fact, then I started getting letters from other tutors who were telling me that there were two of us in this cohort who had been awarded first, and it was the first time in at least 6 years since they'd awarded the first. In those days, everybody gets first. I'm sorry, I didn't really say that. But in those days, you know, it was quite a relatively rare event, you know. And exactly the same thing happened as it started with the O-levels. Same thing happened again. This is a mistake. They're going to look again and realise they've made a mistake. And this is a fraud. I'm a fraud. Yeah. And immediately I started getting courted by one or two of the tutors at King's. Would I like to do a PhD? And I kind of thought, what? And I can remember sitting at home, you know, trying to think this through. And thinking, no, actually, quit whilst you're ahead. You know, because you're a fraud, you know, and you're going to be exposed one of these days as a fraud. Quit whilst you're ahead. And I decided that I wasn't going to do it, actually. And so I said, no, I'd started this course with a purely pragmatic aim in mind, which was to be ordained. Yeah, and that's what I'm going to do. So I went on. In those days, King's had its own outpost of empire down in Canterbury, St. Augustine College. The school is now is, well, that was King's for a few years. It was only King's for about 7 or 8 years. But it coincided with my time. So we were shunted out from the Strand down to Canterbury for a finishing off year before the bishops were then laying hands on us. And we came off, you know. And that was it. I went off, and so my vocation is to be a parish priest. I went off to be a parish priest.
And it's interesting because when I met you in 2004, you were training people who wanted to go into the church, mm-hmm. but who didn't have that professional background, that academic background in theology. So it's as though your own experience you were able to use to the, you know, to help others.
Absolutely.
who also Absolutely. Perhaps had a calling. Yeah. But didn't feel that they had the Absolutely. Right sort of apparatus, the right training
and it did not
to do
that. I've spent quite a lot of my time in the last 30 years now, I suppose, 25, 30 years, teaching mature students. And I think I recognise something of that, again, that I've been through that experience. Because what happened a few years after graduation, well, it was 15, 16 years after graduation, I had no intention of doing anything other than being a parish priest. Yeah. But I had a Patronum Festival coming up in our local parish, and I thought I need a bit of a name for someone to come and do some preaching. And I was desperately trying to think. I thought, oh, Richard Coggins, my old tutor at King's, he doesn't live that far away. Perhaps he would do it. Yeah. So I contacted Richard and said, would you like to come and preach for our Patronum Festival? He said, yeah, I'd love to come and do it. Yeah. He came along and he did a lovely sermon. He was a lovely guy. I don't know if you ever met him, but he was a lovely guy, Old Testament specialist. He only died last year. But Richard came and preached, and then we had him back to the vicarage afterwards for a meal, you know, and sit down and we're chatting. And he was saying, well, how much studying are you doing these days? And I said, oh, you know, I'll pass that, Richard, now, you know, I'm moving on. And we got talking, and we said, Alan, he said, you need to come back and do the MTH, part-time MTH. And I thought, okay, well, why not? You know, and thought about it, and then went through all the calculations about finance and time, could I manage it with a full-time job and the young family and that. But eventually signed up for it. And then got to know people like Leslie Holden, who were at King's in those days, and Graham Stanton, of course, a lovely man, wonderful man at King's. They kind of took me under their wing again and looked after me. And I did quite well in the MTH with that, and to my surprise, got distinction for that. and Leslie Holden was the one who was responsible, because he had his own little problems, as I found out at Cardston. But he was one of my tutors for the MTH, and I'm just about to wrap it up and finish it off, and Leslie said, "So what are you going to do next time?" And I said, "Oh, parish ministry, you know, let's carry on what I'm doing." He said, "Haven't you ever thought of teaching?" I said, "No." And he said, "Well, I think you ought to think about teaching." And it so happened that I started looking around, and one of the things in the Church Times, literally a few days afterwards, Divine Providence again, I don't know, but there was an advert for a New Testament tutor at Cardston. I thought, nah, they won't take me. So I thought, well, Leslie's encouraging me to have a go. I'll have a word with him about it. And I said to him next time, I saw him, "Do you think I'd be in with a shot for this?" And he said, "Go for it." So I did, and he gave me a reference and all the rest of it. I got an interview, and to my astonishment, they offered me the job. So I'm an academic. I don't see myself as an academic, but I've been involved in teaching almost by default.
Yeah, but it's interesting how other people's perceptions sometimes don't coincide with our own. Because when you said that students who you taught years ago asked you for a reference, they see you as I see you, as somebody who is incredibly reliable, as somebody who, of course, teaches theology and, you know, on a religious studies program, and you have all those qualifications. But you did do the doctorate, didn't you?
Yeah.
In later years.
Well, again, same sort of things. I had a lovely kind of gap. So I've got the full set now from King's. I like, so I've got the first degree, master's, and a doctorate. The practical bent thing is still there. I always think my dad was a metal worker, you know, and I think something of that kind of practical, hands-on thing, genetically, kind of passed on a little bit. So for me, the academic stuff has to serve some kind of practical purpose. So I did the MTH and got that. I think that was officially awarded in 1991, something like that. You know, just as I started at King's, at Cudson, I hadn't even got the MTH officially by the time I started at Cudson. And I was, I think, probably one of the last generation where you could get a teaching job without a doctorate. You know, there are not many, there's still one or two, I suppose, but not many. I taught at Cudson, then got the job as principal of site, which involved moving to Medway, or we chose to move to Medway as a strategic place for developing the course at site. And after I'd been doing that for a few years, I thought my teaching was getting a bit tired, and I thought it needed refreshing. And I thought, well, the best way of doing that is to sign up again for a course yourself. And just as I started to think about that, King's advertised this new program called the DMIM. And I thought, well, that's practical. It ticks all the boxes, you know, it brings together my ministerial interests, my sort of academic interests in the Bible and that kind of stuff, you know. It's at the right time, I feel, as if I need to be stretched again. And so I signed up for it. And I'm very proud of this. I was the very first person to qualify for the DMIN at King's. I was slightly miffed at the same time, though, because we signed up. All of us signed up for a doctorate in theology in ministry, and then we were told it was going to be a doctorate in ministry, and that somehow sounds slightly lower down the academic pecking order than that. But at least it's the doctorate, so I have the doctorate from King's.
I think it's safe to say that your academic credentials are not. don't think anybody listening to this will be thinking, oh dear,
fooled.
No. Yeah, but I think Alan, the only person who thinks that is yourself.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. But I mean, it has a knock-on effect because, I mean, as you all know, Chris, only too well, painfully well, these days the way in which you prove your academic credentials is by publications. So it's publications all the time, and because I'm a fraud, I won't publish. Yeah, I hate committing myself to paper, because if I commit myself to paper, you can see how stupid I am.
But you have published.
Yeah, only tiny little bits. Yeah. You know, so I've done one book and a few articles. The mainstay, I've done a few hundred reviews now. But, you know, but that I feel comfortable, I can do that. You know, that's in my league.
And it's interesting because another capacity in which obviously I know you and have worked with you is in the student support work that you've done helping students. And we, and it's very telling because I think this sort of sense of lifelong learning, you seem to embody that. The idea that, you know, even if you don't even have a goal at a certain age, you don't then think, oh, well, that's it, you know, that ship has passed. You've demonstrated that you will go back to that, even though there was no pressure or requirement to do that. And achieve, you know, against the grain perhaps of your own understanding of your own self-worth.
Over the years, and funnily enough, this ties in with the running, actually. One of the reasons I can do the running now, which I couldn't do as a kid, was that as a kid, it was intensely competitive. Yeah, so you always had to win. Yeah, one of the things I've learned in the last 4 years about running is you don't have to win. You have to do it.
How many things in life are process rather than end goal?
I typically, I mean, I did a park run on Saturday, and there were 415 runners, I think, that particular run on Saturday that I took part in, and I came 198th, exactly midfield. Yeah, that's fine. I'm never going to come first. I don't want to come first. Yeah, I can plod around and do it. Now, it's the same thing with the academic stuff. I don't have to be one of these high flyers. I was going to mention a few names there. We've got a few on the staff at Kent who are stratospherically above me in terms of their intellect, perception, analytical skills, imaginative creative writing, and so on and so forth. You know, I don't have to be them. I have to be me.
And sometimes those people, brilliant though they are, they have talents in areas. You know, we all work as a team, and I think that that's the crucial thing. And I think we all play to our strengths. And some people are always, you know, as you are actually incredibly. You know, you've done so much teaching for us over the years. You are incredibly respected. and perhaps you don't see that, because in many cases you've taught modules for people who, for whatever reason, might have been absent, and you have saved our bacon quite literally.
Well, I enjoy it. I mean, I get a buzz out of teaching. I don't know whether this is just a cop out, but I kind of feel more comfortable in kind of an oral genre than in the written genre, you know. So it's back to the narrative stuff, really. You know, I can tell a story, I can tell a tale. And in terms of preaching, actually, that's one of the things that really frightens the hell out of me, in that how easy it is to be persuasive in the oral genre, you know. I can stand up in church and talk complete rubbish, and people will say thank you afterwards, you know. And sometimes I will stand up and I know that I've been talking complete crap, you know. And you just kind of think, it's just how easy it is to understand people like Hitler, Stalin, Trump, you know, people who can be rhetorically powerful when they're talking complete rubbish. Yeah, persuasiveness, and it's actually quite fun.
No, and that's a conversation I've had with some of my other interviewees about the way in which sometimes, you know, it ain't what you say, it's the way that you say it, and sometimes having a particular authority, and maybe it's the post that you hold. I mean, that, you know, this is not the time to talk about it, but, you know, David Jenkins, Bishop of Durham, he was saying things that if he'd remained an academic, nobody would have batted an eyelid, perhaps. But suddenly, when you say it as Bishop of Durham, then suddenly it's a completely different ballgame. And it's the office that you hold sometimes that, rather than the words in themselves, and how that's disseminated. I've got two more questions. One was actually, I want you to go back to what you were saying at the beginning about flying. I'm fascinated about that trajectory.
Well, that's another new challenge. And actually, I'm going through another one of these fraud things. This is a big theme, obviously, in my life. But I'm going through. I've now got 9 or 10 hours flying experience as a student pilot. Now, it's another new thing that it's something I've always wanted to do. I can, you know, Biggles as a child, you know, and reading some of these stories. And my uncle, my maternal uncle, was the only member of our immediate close family who had been directly involved in the Second World War, and he had been in bomber command. He had been, actually wasn't a pilot, but he'd been a navigator and gunner, and he'd been shot down and been taken POW, and so on and so forth. So as a young child, I can remember him telling me stories about his experience and so on. So for me, the great hero thing was to to be able to fly. But, you know, in the Church of England doesn't pay its clergy particularly well, and flying is an astonishingly expensive hobby. So it was never an option. You know, I could never afford to go flying, and it's something I deferred and thought I'd just loved to be able to do it, but couldn't afford it. Now, because of recent bereavement and, you know, bounce effect and all those kind of things, and the fact that that coincides with me getting quite a lot of money, endowment money, that I've been saving up over the years. Now I've retired, I'm starting to get all this money coming in, and I've still got to decide what's going to be done with it seriously. We just suddenly said, a few months ago now, just said, sod it, I'm going to spend some of this money on flying. I've always wanted to do it. Now I have to put not my money where my mouth is, but my body where my mouth is. And because I am fairly clumsy and also very nervous about this kind of fraud thing and all the rest of it, I am really struggling. And you catch me at this precise moment in time. I had a conversation, I had a lesson on Thursday last week, where my instructor was very kindly and gently beginning to open out the question about whether or not I'm actually going to be able to do this. Yeah. So the fraud syndrome is really hitting again.
But also remember, it's process rather than end goal. It doesn't matter. Yeah. You know, you're fulfilling an ambition.
Yeah. And I keep trying. I've got another lesson due tomorrow. It's always weather dependent, but it looks like the weather's going to be fine tomorrow. So I have my next lesson tomorrow, and I know that I should be as nervous as hell beforehand. But then the adrenaline buzz when you get back down again and you've done a little bit of it. I'm making painfully slow progress. It really is. But it's a very physical thing. And what I haven't got yet is that the muscle memory, you know, where your body becomes an extension of the machine. I can remember it when learning to drive a car. I ride a motorbike, same sort of thing there as well. You know, you have to allow your body to become part of the machine. Yeah, and I'm nowhere near that yet with the aircraft. Yeah, I'm fighting it all the time.
Well, that actually inadvertently segues into my last question, because although we've been talking a lot about the past, what strikes me is that there's, you know, you've got these goals, and you know, you always maybe not in the right sort of order, or you know, at the time when perhaps the opportunity first arose. But my last question was whether you consider yourself a looking back or a looking forward kind of person.
To look forward. I mean, the one thing that you have to look for. I'm going to make a theological point. I'm going to be a theologian for a second. But except I hate to. This goes back to all the stuff about kings. When people ask me what I am, I will say I'm a priest who does some teaching. I refuse to accept the label theologian, because a theologian is a Bortman or a Bart or somebody who is, you know, really clever. You know, out there. So I'm not a theologian, but I want to be theological for a moment on that. And I want to say that Christian theology has this incredible knack of being able to reframe the past with the future. So it's all about reframing the past. Yeah? So my past is reframed by my future. Mm? And at one level, my future, my next goal is death. Because, you know, that's the natural cycle. You know, I'm moving into the last phase, the last quarter. Okay? I've no idea how long it will be. It might be long, it might be short, who knows? Yeah. But the Christian claim is that that reality of death, that reality of our human mortality, is itself reframed by an eternal transcendence, which I hesitate to articulate too clearly, or attempt to articulate too clearly, an apophatic theology, I think, needs to kick in at this particular stage. You know, I have no idea what lies beyond. But the pull of the Christian story is always towards God's future. Yeah? So your past is defined by God's future.
Yeah. Helen, this has been so inspiring. But thank you very much for sharing your memories, past, and your hopes, present and future, with us today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.